Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Aaron McNeil. Hey Aaron.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Yeah, it's pretty good. We're face-to-face for probably the first time, which is pretty special. So yes. Thanks for making the trip up to Sunny Coast.
Thanks for having me. I mean, this is the third time we've tried to record this, so hopefully the last time. So I feel like you need no introduction because I think with this podcast, you're part of the furniture now.
Great. You've just had aging in the background.
You've had two episodes with us. So one being with the Free Rads when you were doing that, and also the Study Cheat Code podcast episode we did a little while ago. So I recommend everyone to go jump on those. But you're doing something a little bit different now since the last time we had a chat on the podcast. So do you want to let everyone know sort of what you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. So since about November last year, I've been working at the Sunshine Coast University Hospital as a physician assistant in the emergency department. So that role basically generated from a rapid assessment model that's been starting to proliferate in some hospitals around Australia and Queensland. But specifically with that role, they brought us in to do rapid assessments on patients from the waiting room, so they weren't waiting for treatment. And then we could sift those patients from, you know, low acuity to those who probably needed direct intervention straight away. So it's more of a, medical model than what I was doing before in ambulance, which is more pre-hospital care. So I've got that, that autonomy now to sort of make diagnoses or at least have a decent differential to start ordering tests to prove my own thought stream of what's happening with them at the moment. But that's now starting to, grow as well. So we're moving into the fast track area, and then there's a plan to go into acute and then onto the resus team as well. So we are sort of that medical intermediate that is, working like a doctor in a sense, under supervision, but still, still have those powers.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I actually never knew that existed until you said that you, one, did the course, and then I didn't know you could actually work as one in Australia, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you're about to see quite a few of them over in London, so it's quite established over there.
Yeah, right.
And I think what we're seeing now is that with workforces, with what they are and trying to find stability, it's a new role such like the NP roles or the nurse practitioner roles that I think is going to proliferate in Australia quite deeply.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I mean, that ties in really nicely to what we're going to talk about today, which is mainly going through sort of clinical assessment, sort of going through more of an advanced clinical assessment. And I guess just to open up that understanding of there's a lot more to learn. And I think if you put yourself out there to learn it, you're able to then utilize it a little bit better. And something to sort of kick off that discussion was something I saw yesterday, actually, by Lindsay, who is the pre-hospitalist on Instagram, and she said there's a big difference between scope of practice versus scope of knowledge. So I feel like that's a really cool sort of comparison to be like, well, you can actually learn a lot more and you can utilize that then to be able to make an impact in your clinical assessment.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about that this morning, actually, especially when it comes to whatever that patient is presenting with. You're only going to be able to sort of sieve through what you think is happening based on your knowledge at that time in your career, right? And that can grow from, it's endless, really. You can take it wherever you want to, but it's up to you to take it where you think you need to be or what you want to be when it comes to, a pre-hospital clinician in this role. So I think that's probably a good place to start, really, because I talk about sort of in the past I've talked about examination and history taking quite a lot. I guess that's probably the focus or the bedrock of all of this. But I want to go back, you know, like a step or two before we even get there. And I just want to talk about vital signs. Okay, so I don't want to get away from that vital signs are king in this scenario. This is pre-hospital care. It's mastery of your A, Bs, and Cs, right? And mastery in that is to recognize when your patient is shocked or, you know, they're sort of heading towards the cliff. Okay, so a fresh set of vital signs to direct what is happening and how the severity of what's in front of you, I think, is extremely important, and we need to do that as quickly as possible, right? And that starts from walking the doors, like looking at your patient going, oh, they look unwell. Okay, let's get a blood pressure. Can I feel a pulse? And then can I get a bit of a story to blend in what's actually happening in front of me, okay? And then we can sort of jump in. So if you've got that patient where you're like, oh, look, I've got a bit of time, I can dig a bit further, I can really get into that history, right? And the brilliant thing about the history or what that patient will tell you is it will steer 80% of the diagnosis, right? So before doing anything else, just going, hey, why have you called the ambulance today? And letting that person talk is going to fill 80% of your diagnostic criteria to figure out what's going on, okay? And I think that's pretty common. Like, I can't see anyone really, I would hope anyway, someone saying that I've got chest pain and they're like, cool, so tell me about your big toe. That's, you know, not dressed because it's sticking out from your sock. And you're like, no one's going to do that, right? You hear chest pain and immediately you're just thinking MI, PE, pneumothorax, dissection, right? That should be the only thoughts in your head. And from whatever else they tell you, you start to like craft in or fill in the gaps of what else is going on here, okay? You can do all these assessments and you can get all this history, but at the end of the day, you don't have imaging and blood tests and all that. A lot of the things we have is a clinical diagnosis, right? So I don't look at an ECG and think, yep, that's ST elevation, but I'm going to wait for the troponin. Okay, and that's a bad example, I know that. But a lot of the times, whatever I have in front of me, I can't just order tests and just go, well, I'll just wait for those to happen. I've got to have something in the back of my mind thinking that I'm at least 90% sure of what's going on here to prove what I think is about to happen or what is happening to this patient, right? And those tests are only to prove or disprove something, okay? So in that context, just remember, whatever is in your head and what you think is happening is the raw material of what we're trying to actually get out of these patients so we treat them effectively, right? Don't sort of like sit on your hind haunches and go, I don't know, this is too hard. If it's too hard, get your phone out and just, rattle off some things and think, okay, well, could this be happening? You know, could this be due to their medication? I don't know what their medication is, so let's just look up what the adverse effects are. So whatever you have like in your head mentally is what's going to matter, not the tests, okay? And I think that's the most important part of this entire conundrum. I don't know if that's something you agree with or...
No, I'm just thinking about it because, you know, obviously having some experience, you know, going through as a student paramedic and then working in the ED, I totally agree with that in a sense too because, you know, someone will come in and yes, say, for example, you're thinking PE and, you know, they need to go for that CTPA or they need to go, you know, you're waiting on a D-dimer, for example, even though that's, you know, can be false positives at the time. You know, like at the end of the day, you're going to treat them regardless. Like if you need, if their breathing's out of whack or their oxygenation's out of whack, you're going to sort that out anyway. Like I feel like particularly in the pre-hospital environment, treatment is very, you know, symptomatic and ABCs and recognizing that deterioration and being able to hand that over to the appropriate people at the right time, whether that be the triage nurse, the bedside nurse if you're on the ramp, whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, it's great to have all those tests and that's what helps, I guess, figure out that journey for the patient. But right then and there as a paramedic, you know, you're treating what's in front of you and what, you know, planning ahead for what may happen.
Absolutely. So typically what I teach in like university is, or in other educational streams, is you've got two types of patients. You've got the patient who doesn't look well and you're really worried they're going to deteriorate in front of you, and you can go through and do that sample approach, right, where you're just asking some really narrow questions to get an idea of what's happening. And for the most part of it, the black and white pathologies, like your MI or your STEMI, OMI, or anything that's happening right in front of you, will be apparent, right? Abdo pain, shocked, AAA until proven otherwise, right? You don't need to do anything else at that point. You don't need to sort of like, oh, I'm going to put my hands in their belly. You're like, no, you need to get access and get the hell out to, you know, a vascular surgeon. And it's this, but if they're not, you know, like unstable in that manner, right? You know, you've got time, and I would really promote doing a thorough history. So figuring out the exact time of when these symptoms started, okay? And then trying to ascertain, is this something that's new today or is it a chronic feature? You know, what's associated with it? Does it have radiating features? Have they just had surgery that could complicate this, or they just started a new medication? What's in their individual pathology and their background that would be more reasonable to be causing their symptoms today, right? So, you know, you get someone who is, you know, in renal failure or end-stage renal failure, and they've got benign vomiting. That person is hyperkalemic until proven otherwise. You need to get an ECG and go, is that wide? Yep, it's a YQRS. We need to treat that right now, right? That's where your mind should be. This is pre-hospital care. Not, okay, well, let's figure out the nuances of, you know, why they're vomiting and think about the vomiting center in the brain. That's just, you don't need that, okay? If you do get led astray, though, and you're like, look, nothing's really coming together, do a systems review. Do a head-to-toe, okay, well, I don't really know what's happening at the moment. I don't feel like I'm getting all the information I need. Hey, let's start with the head. You know, are you getting headaches, neck stiffness, photophobia, blurred vision, what have you? Okay, and then work your way down from system to system. So cardiovascular, respiratory, gastrointestinal, you know, skin, the whole lot, right? And then see if that any of that will then piece together what you're trying to find, okay? And again, if it's not making sense or there's something that you don't know, pull out your phone and look it up. Who cares? If you've got time, that's brilliant. That might be the difference of transporting them to a hospital that doesn't have a facility that can manage them, or take them to somewhere where it's more appropriate, right? So I think if you can take those like little nuances in, you'll be completely fine, you'll be safe, and it'll also expand your horizons as well, right? Because you'll start to like make connections that you probably didn't make in uni because you haven't been in front of those patients yet. But stick to those red flags as well. If we stay in those realms, you're completely safe. You'll pick up so much. And it's just, I guess it's just paying attention, right? Mm. If you're active with that patient to actually want to know what's going on with them, great. If you get the job and just go, oh, Christ, another abdominal pain, then straight away you've biased yourself. You're going to walk in there, and if things go south, you're the one to blame because you didn't pick up, or you allowed yourself to get discouraged about, you know, a particular symptom that either you're not comfortable with or that you don't think you can do a lot with. But you can, right? Because it's just a history.
Absolutely. And you bring up a good point in terms of thinking about, I guess, that worst case scenario. And like you said, it's that until it's proven otherwise, and particularly because you don't have those things like ultrasound to be able to figure out if it is actually, say, a torsion of an ovary or, you know, an ectopic pregnancy, for example. So that you bring up a good point there. In terms of questioning, and when you've talked about doing it systematically with your systems, head to toe, what about understanding the reason why you're asking what you're asking? Because we're going to go into some, like you, we've talked about before, but some advanced sort of thinking around these types of assessments. How important is it to actually understand the why behind what you're asking?
So I think when things become vague or they're not black and white. Okay, so as a pre-hospital clinician, I think your job is grey and you need to be able to sift out the black and the white from the grey. Okay, so if you don't have an intuition or at least a reasonable thought of what is actually happening to this person, then and you can't ask those questions to try and differentiate where you're going, that's when you're going to get caught out, right? That's when you're going to say, oh, I've got this person, they've got vertigo. They've said they've got the vertigo and the room's spinning around them and I saw nystagmus. So it's vertigo, except they've got nystagmus in both directions and you've actually missed a posterior stroke and you've sat on the ramp for 3 hours because you've sold it so well and now you're in that realm of, well, if they had their CT, you know, will they have a deficit after this, you know? Worst comes to worst, they start seizing on you and you're like, I don't know why, they just had vertigo. So that's that basis of sort of going, I need to protect this patient against this pathology and I need to be asking those questions to make sure that I can either reasonably rule it out or have a suspicion that it's actually happening. So that would be the most important part for me.
That's really interesting you say that, in the sense of when you're trying to, say, hand it over to your triage nurse or whatever it may be, that you're kind of underselling it. And is there a risk in just doing that in general? Like, because like you said, it could be that person who has vertigo, but they're actually having a posterior stroke.
One of the best, ways I've tried to translate this to others is have that patient where you've just told me that story. If that was on a piece of paper and you're being marked at uni for this, what are you actually going to write down? You're not going to write down nothing wrong with the patient because you know you're going to get 0 out of 10 or whatever it is, right? You would read that and go, I've got a child who has had subjective fevers, who's now having a severe headache, sounds migraineous, but they're vomiting with photophobia and neck stiffness. You're gonna sit there and go, oh, okay, probably meningitis. I want to rule out meningitis, right? You're not going to sit there and go, yeah, just a headache, whingy kid. Okay, because you can't, obviously, one, you can't write that on any exam. You get thrown out, or at least hopefully your lecturer would talk to you. But you can't just, if you get those sort of like those signs and you're looking at someone going, but why are they so well? You're like, well, maybe the disease has not taken its course. Nothing just happens in an instant, right? The things that happen in an instant is when you explode a vessel and you start to bleed into your brain and you become unconscious, okay? Or you get struck by, you're in a car accident and you tear through your aorta and you bleed out completely within seconds. You're like, oh, that's really weird. They only got hit by 40 kilometers. And you're like, well, something's clearly happened. Okay, so I think it's just taking a step back and going, okay, they look well now, but will they look well in 30 minutes or 5 minutes, an hour or 3 hours? And when you're at triage, you might just want to say, hey, I'm concerned about these possibilities. They're currently stable, but this is their history. You might just want to start that conversation like that, just so one, it alerts that triage nurse and doctor, if they're around there, to go, okay, yeah, no, that's fair. We probably do need to worry about that. In the next few hours might be reasonable. Maybe now, who knows? Mm. But obviously, that's going to depend. So please just know, when we start talking about exam, I'm just talking about the stuff that you can do in your practice that can help you get to a diagnosis or at least sort of ascertain the severity of that diagnosis as well. Okay. You want to start off with some neuro stuff?
Let's do it. I feel like neuro is done pretty bad or taught pretty bad as a student. Like all I learned was the acronym was Violent Ladies PMSing. And so V, you know, verbal, L, level of consciousness /GCS, and then pupils, motor, and sensory. Like that's all I learned. And until I did private, then I realized, well, there's lots more.
Okay. So again, a cranial nerve exam is can take you seconds, and all you're really doing is just getting that person to move their face. You know, squinting their eyebrows, lifting their eyebrows, moving their eyes in, you know, a lateral and vertical plane, and then just getting them to smile. Okay, there's a few other things. You can test their hearing or whatever. However, you don't need to remember every single, like, cranial nerve palsy, okay? All I would, like, want you to do is go, oh, that's abnormal. And could that be contributing to this person's presentation right now? Or do you just need to ask them, hey, do you know that this happens? And he's like, and they're like, yeah, I know my eye doesn't track that way. That's normal for me. You're like, okay, cool. We've got some information. That in concert with things like a complete peripheral exam, okay, which is not just your grips and pulling in, it's shoulder abduction, adduction, it's being out, it's the strength in your wrists and your fingers as well. Again, you don't have to do all of these as well. We just want to know what gross motor tone is, okay? So I've jostled with you with this about before, or well, comically anyway, about the FAST exam. You know, that's for the community. You know, that's what I'd expect someone at triage to do when, you know, they've got 20 characters or less to type in and do some form of assessment, right? When it comes to stroke anyway, not a complete assessment. So if someone's got sort of like what you think is benign or subtle stroke signs, you need to go through the entire lot, okay? And we do see people who come in with, you know, like altered sensation in their thumb and, you know, pointer finger and get sent home, and then they get an MRI 24 hours later and they're like, hey, you've had a stroke. But if we can at least do those gross things first and figure out if they're abnormal, great. We can maybe drill down and go, oh, well, we're finding some subtle signs here and that needs to be passed over, okay? The same thing with when it comes to like spinal pathologies, particularly corda equina, right? Because you're never going to see cornus media or whatever it is. But the people, like, we see so many people with back pains, and the only thing we really care about with back pains is, could this be causing a spinal cord dysfunction that needs surgery, right? So we just want to ask those big topic questions. Have you ever had spinal surgery before, or anything else around your spine? Have you been incontinent? Have you lost power in your lower limbs? And, you know, can you get like any focal tenderness as well? Okay. Have they used drugs before, especially IV drugs that would create an abscess around there? And we can go, oh, this is corda equina. Let's get them to a hospital that can actually, you know, do neurosurge. Or maybe you're out west and that needs to be translated, you know, to get RFDS or whatever your flight facility is. So, you know, like the neuro stuff is, again, it's just taking another step to just do a little bit more, and it takes seconds. You know, we're not talking about you pulling out an encyclopedia and trying to read out all these instructions. It's just 12 things you need to get someone to do on their face and then actually get your hands on with what their limbs can do. I'm not too sure. So we talked about vertigo before, right? I'm not going to go through a HINTS examination, but if you have someone with vertigo, just remember that could be a sign of something else. It's the same if someone has a migraine. Make sure that it's the same pattern of their migraine. They don't have any co-contaminant features of being febrile or signs of meningism, right? So a HINTS exam is just head impulse. So it's basically like rocking the neck to see what happens with the eyes. Checking for nystagmus. And if you don't if you don't even look this up, if you just go, okay, I'm just going to ask that person to track my finger with their eyes. And if you see nystagmus in both directions, just go, okay, it's probably not vertigo. It's probably a central lesion and I need to be worried about that. Okay, that's it. If you handed that over at triage and a doctor heard that, they will jump on that straight away, okay? And then there's test askew, where you're just basically covering their eyes up and just seeing if their eye just goes wonky. It's actually really fun, especially when you see it, and then you kind of see it and you're like, oh, sorry, mate. But, you know, a lot of fun to do. So, like, if we just stick to those, you are already covering off, like, the big pathologies that we need to be aware of. The only thing I'm going to add there is things like mangianism. And it's just checking for, like, nuchal rigidity. So do you pull their neck up and they scream at you, or do you, when they're lying down and you bend their knees up to their chest, do they scream at you because you're stretching their spinal cord and it's irritating the hell out of them, right? And that's your neuro exam done. And you've done it in less than a couple of minutes, right? You could do it on your stretch. Like, you could get them on your stretcher after you're like, okay, well, I'm not really concerned. Their vital signs are pretty good. Yeah, they're febrile and they've said they've got back pain. Or they're febrile and they've got neck stiffness and a headache. I can do all those things on my stretcher, right? Super easy. I guess the point, though, is that if you don't practice doing these things, you'll never recognize what's abnormal from normal. It's the same as looking at ECGs all the time and just going, okay, well, that doesn't look right. That's not a sinus rhythm. That QT looks pretty long. Is that going to affect this patient with what they've just told me? Like, they did just say they had a syncope with a QTC of 580. Yeah, sure, they might go into VT or TULSARTS. It's probably possible. You know, so it's just being able to recognize what's abnormal, all right? But I think the big things, especially for us, right, is the cardiopulmonary assessment, right? So putting your hands, checking pulses and, you know, listening to chests. You know, when it comes to things like, you're like, oh, okay, this person's got chest pain. Like, my normal thing in a rapid assessment scenario where I've, you know, literally got 7 minutes to, by myself, get vital signs, an ECG, get access and take bloods and then start ordering everything else. Plus then, if I think I need to elevate that person's care to an SMO or like a consultant, is to just go, cool, I'm going to feel both radials. Okay, they're equal. Probably don't have to worry about a dissection, all right? But if there's a delay, I'm like, oh, okay, well, first, again, I'm going to go back to that patient. Hey, have you had surgery on this arm? Yes, people can't feel my pulse in that arm. Like, great, awesome. Maybe I'll just go up to the brachial artery to see if there's a delay, because that's a way more significant sign than just unequal blood pressures, right? But once I've done that, I'm like, I'm listening to heart sounds. I can hear lub dub, fantastic. They're not muffled. They're not distant. I don't see any JVD. They've got a clear chest. Okay, cool. All I'm really worried about now is the ECG, right? And I can just take that away whatsoever. So in those scenarios, again, it's just I've listened to thousands of chests. I know what normal is. I know what crepes sound like. I know what wheezes sound like. I know what no air sounds like, hopefully. Same with heart sounds. The only way you get good at it is just listening to them all the time, knowing what your landmarks are and just going, okay, I can hear lub dub. Fantastic. I've talked about this before. You know, if you have someone who is having a STEMI in front of you and you're worried about, I need to stop saying STEMI. Scott will kill me. Omi. Sorry, Scott. You know, and you're concerned, like, you know, and they start to look worse to you and you're like, okay, well, are they deteriorating? And, you know, when you first listen to those heart sounds after you've done everything else, okay, do not listen to heart sounds before you've done a checklist and referred that patient, for crying out loud. But if you listen to them, go, okay, they were normal, and then you listen to them again, you're like, oh, that sounds like a violent whoosh now. That's probably them going into, like, that might be the first sign you get for them going into cardiogenic shock. So these are just things that can protect you as well, right? They're not just like, ooh, fancy heart sounds. But then, like, you know, just checking your peripheries. Are they warm? Are they cold? Do you have good pulses to all your peripheries? What's the cat refill like? Are there signs of cyanosis or pallor? These are just these little subtle things where you're like, I was concerned. Their blood pressure says they're good, but geez, they just don't. This picture doesn't look well at all. And I think that's where we need to really take that, right?
Absolutely. I think it's all about that recognizing deterioration or setting yourself up for success really at the end of the day, because if that person's going to deteriorate in like half an hour, you know, at least you're kind of on the ball already, like, this doesn't look right, you know, and then you're able to escalate that care when you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, we don't need to be trigger happy. We can sort of like, you know, just like watch and wait in sometimes as well, just as long as you have that in the back of your mind, okay? And they're really like the only really big three systems we need to worry about, right? Like I said before, the abdominal pain, shocked, you know, they're bleeding until proven otherwise, or they've got a like a mesenteric ischemia until proven otherwise, okay? But put that together, you know, a 70-year-old male who presents shocked with abdominal pain, 170 of those are going to have an underlying aneurysm that they weren't aware about beforehand, you know? Vice versa, if you got the person who is, you know, the 50 or 60-year-old female who's had AF for the past 20 years, and is throwing clots around and now has abdominal pain and is just vomiting violently, sure, that could be mesenteric ischemia, okay? Especially if you put your hands on their stomach and like they're not sore anywhere. You're like, okay, well, that's really weird. Like, they look really unwell, but my examination doesn't like take this into account, right? So one of the things that scares me the most, right, is septic shock. Mm. And particularly when it comes to things like neck fash, right? Because I don't know if you've ever seen neck fash before.
Don't think I have. Okay.
So this is stuff where, like, I've seen people who have just come in and they're like, I've just got this bruising and stuff on my leg and it just feels hot and it's really painful. And you're looking at them going, okay, you've got pain out of proportion to what that looks like. And then it just evolves in front of you. You just start to see this blistering in front of you. And they're like, I'm really not feeling well. I'm getting nauseous. And you're like, oh, God. And then you just see their heart rate go up and they just dump their blood pressure. And, you know, if you're like me, you have at least a 2 to 3 second, you know, stun mullet occasion. Or, and then you run your ass down the hallway. Well, if you're me, you press the emergency button and I run into resus and go, you need to come this way now. But those sort of things where you have someone who then rapidly deteriorates on you, like take a step back and just sort of go, how did that happen? You know, are they bleeding profusely? Is this an infection that is just going absolutely haywire? Or is this like an infarct because it's happened so quickly, right? So you can pull back from what your examination was and go, why aren't those two matching up? And there's going to be like a very serious cause why. So putting all that together, you've had your history, you've done your systems review, you've looked at your patient gone, oh, look, they're a vascular path or they're a diabetic, so they're going to be compromised in some manner, and I've done an examination that is thorough, then you can really start to like pull together a differential diagnosis that was probably, it's probably going to be spot on most of the time. I'd say probably more like 85% of the time you're going to be right on the money, right? Or you're at least making sure that if those things do happen, you're prepared, right? Because if you open your kit up at the moment, right? So like if you have that person, like the septic shock patient, right? You know, I've got access to vancomycin, meropenem, you name it, after a call to infectious diseases. But, I can call someone. But you've got ketroxone, okay? Or if you're in New South Wales, you've got benzoyl penicillin, right? I can't remember what Vic has. But you might need to, you know, make that phone call and go, I've got this person deteriorating. I think this is sepsis. I want to do this. If you've got ketroxone, I'd rather that person who's deteriorating in front of you get the antibiotic after a phone call and squeeze in as much fluid as possible instead of waiting for cultures, which, you know, I don't
days anyway.
I don't really care about anyway, right? it's just like, you have this, I think this is what's happening. Screw the sensitivity of the cultures. Just make sure that person doesn't die on you. Okay. And you might need to get creative, but you can only get creative if you know what your equipment is and what it can and can't do, right? And where it stretches to. If you want to stick to the letter of your the book, where it says you can only use it for this, and then you're not aware of its other uses, like droperidol, one of my favorite antiemetics going around, right? At, you know, anywhere between 1.25 and 2 milligrams, okay?
Yeah.
IV.
When I had to give that as an infusion, I was like freaking out. I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna knock off. they're gonna go unconscious. And then it doesn't happen because obviously it's a different dose, different use.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you have the ability to pick up a phone and say, hello, you know, medical director or consult line person, you know, this is what I want to do, you know. And if you have that understanding, you translate that understanding, I think most of the time, you know, you'll be able to, you know, get that approval, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in particular, one of the episodes that should be out now and people listening to this was about sepsis anyway. And you know, we have, like you said, ceftriaxone here in Queensland. And realistically, for example, if you're at rural and it's going to be hours before that person gets flown out to Brisbane or wherever their tertiary hospital is, you know, they may need that. And, you know, thinking, like you said, about outside of the box, what else can these be used for? Or at least calling me like, hey, I've got this person, what should I be doing? If you're very unsure. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting like dynamic, and I think that you get sort of shoeboxed into these are my drugs and these are what I can use for, like, for them for, whereas there's a, you know, a whole world outside of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But all this will be based on that phone call will be based on the fact that you've done such a thorough history, such a great examination, and you've correlated that to the patient's actual, like, underlying pathologies and their medications, maybe their social history as well, and translated that to that person. And they're going to know that they're like, I just can't imagine anyone would just hear a really good, succinct story and then just go, yeah, no, I don't want you to do that. You know, that doesn't sound reasonable to save that person's life at the moment. You know, and it's the same thing when you get to a triage or you get in front of a medical officer and you translate that information, it's another way of lighting up the system where then they will jump into action much quicker. If you just go, oh, look, they've just had this and they've had it before and, you know, I'm not really worried. You know, I like, the best example I can give is seeing like an 80-year-old, oh, was she 80? Maybe she was 70. Regardless, elderly female. Who came in, and I've been told that from one of my colleagues that you know, she's had chest pain for a week. I'm like, okay, cool, no worries. But she still has subtle depression on her ECG. And then talking with her, she's like, yeah, I've had every time I get up and I move, I get this kind of this chest pain, and then it sort of goes away. I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds like angina. How far can you walk? I'm like, 30 meters. I'm like, oh, that's pretty bad. It's pretty unstable. And then they say, oh, and then overnight last night, I just got the worst pain I've ever had just sitting watching TV. She actually had a really funny story. I got so sweaty, had to take all my clothes off. I'm like, cool, didn't need to know that, but really good. And I was really breathless, and that lasted about 40 minutes. And then I'd like all day today, I just haven't felt well. I'm like, oh, you've had an event. You've absolutely had an event. And her troponin came back at like 400 or something like that, right? And, you know, again, she had an OMI. There was clear depression on there that was different from her last ECGs. And I believe a lot of my colleagues have Viewer now. So that's one thing that you can just look up and go, hey, I'll just check if there's an old ECG here that I can look at, and if it's different, whatever. But, you know, that person got handed over to me, or at least I got told about it in my current position. And it was like nothing had been done. I'm like, okay, well, here's an aspirin. Granted, she was pain-free, but, you know, there was that potential that something else could happen in that space, right? So I guess that's when that, you know, those details and sifting through them, you make sure that, like, I've done it before as well, right? Someone's going, oh, I've had this for months. I'm like, God damn it, months, mate. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. How's months get a 000 call at 3 o'clock in the morning? And then you start to talk to them, you're like, oh, okay, actually this has gone from like something that's being sort of either building or they're just associating it to something that they've had before. It's completely different now because you've done a thorough examination, right?
Absolutely. And even that too, like you get that a lot and you have your 70-year-old who wants to tell you their whole life story. And then you're like, hang on, but you come back to that question of, so what's changed in the past day, 24 hours to make you want to come in via ambulance or come into the hospital? And then they'll be like, oh, actually, this has gotten worse. I think we're pretty notorious, healthcare workers in general are pretty notorious for interrupting the patient. If you just let them give you a story for couple minutes, you're able to go, oh, okay, so this is quite, it might be a bit convoluted, but then you're like, okay, I've got a bit of a sort of understanding, and then I'll direct my questioning from there. But I feel like within, you know, seconds, we jump in straight away.
But you're also taught to do that, right? So if you think about how OSCEs are set up for you to ask questions and gain answers, okay? And it's and for lack of a better term, it's a shit way to do it. Because that's not how people sort of answer things, but it's, I guess, at the moment, it's the only way we have to sort of qualify if you know what you're actually doing, right? Or if you're thinking of what the steps are to, you know, gain that diagnosis, right? So that's why I said at the start, you know, get those vital signs. If they look stable, the patient looks stable to you, take a couple of minutes. Just let them talk, right? Because they will just, they'll rabbit on. And then you can start to, again, for lack of a better term, cherry pick what's actually important in that story and then steer them around, okay? It's like those things where you say, did this come on spontaneously? Was it sudden? Has it been sort of like a crescendo building up? Those things will really highlight a lot of what's actually happening, okay? I guess the beauty of all of this is it will actually make you smarter, right? It will draw out information that you've already learnt and build upon that as well, because then you've, like, you know, you can't – experience doesn't make you good in any manner. It doesn't make you a master or anything, okay? It doesn't make you a senior whatever. Okay, it just means you've been around for a while. Okay, so if you haven't sort of constantly reflected and then developed that sense of you know, improving your approach all the time, and then drawing out you know, that anatomy, physiology, and pathology that you should be continually learning all the time through your career, then you're going to get stuck wherever you were. And whatever you've seen, okay? So if you haven't seen someone who's, I don't know, preeclamptic or eclamptic, or maybe you've never actually been to an actual septic shock, like a true septic shock where you're like, you're up to your third presser in 60 minutes and you're sitting there just like putting your hands over your face just going, oh, God, this is not... I think I just need to break myself, or I need to start myself on presses. Then you're not going to have that appreciation of what's happening in front of you, period, right? You're just going to say, I saw this last time and it was completely fine. Crap, it's not fine this time, okay? Or you just bias yourself into your own way to take a history and it's just benign all the time, you know? And you want to talk about what they ate 3 days ago or something like that, or, you know, whatever. But that will come down, again, that will come down, that's a classic example of someone who is just plateaued completely and probably like deteriorated in their own knowledge because they haven't seen things and haven't stayed active in it, right? So I remember, like, so the things that have stuck with me the most, right? So even in my new role, just to sort of, I guess, round this off, is every SMO who I do training with every fortnight or gives me some sort of form of guidance during my shift always says, what's going to kill them first? All the time. They don't, you know, and if you start talking to them and you're like, oh, no, that sounds okay. But they will say, what do we need to worry about, right? Because they're the things that are going to kill them or cause a harm to this patient, right? And it's the same thing that, shout out to Tony Hucker, the one thing I remember him saying is it's your pathology and what you know now and what you grow from there is going to make you a great clinician, right? And same thing with, you know, Steve Rashford, when I first saw him as a graduate in, you know, that hall, him saying that don't underestimate why people call 000. Like if you look for pathology, you will find it on the daily. And he's completely right. Like the amount of things that I see in, you know, just a normal day is mind blowing. Well, at least I think that way anyway, right? So we just have to take that sort of grain of salt in our job and just go, okay, someone's called. Why? What's happened? And can we actually find something with our ability, because it's your ability, to make this patient safe and go on to live, you know, the healthy or life that they want to live.
I love that. That's a great way to wrap it up. And I think in terms of that as well, you know, like you said, knowledge is power pretty much. So the more you learn these things, the better you're going to be able to help the people that you are looking after at the end of the day. And then equally, the more you practice it, the better. So as students, get involved, get into those scenarios. Don't sit at the back freaked out that you're going to have to do a scenario. Like, get involved, do it. It's your learning at the end of the day. And the best way in which you'll be able to progress your knowledge and being able to reflect on that and find where you need to work on and reflect on those cases that you go to and then really delve into what can you do next time. And that might be one extra question that you may want to ask or a different assessment, like hints, for example. If you do go to a vertigo patient, you might want to extend yourself a little bit in terms of that. So there's lots of room to grow. And I think, you know, that is up to you as the individual, how far you want to grow. And that's the beauty of these types of jobs in healthcare. There is no sort of set limit on what you want to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Don't put limits on yourself. Once you do that, you may as well just go sit in a corner, in a dark corner, and just fade away.
Well, don't fade away. Well, thank you so much for jumping on today, Aaron. This was awesome. Thank you so much, and I hope everyone will take something away from this. Where are some really good resources people can go to be able to extend themselves on this stuff?
Yeah, so Geeky Medics is probably one of my favorite resources, just because they've got so many cool pictures. There's a really cool dot point publication called the EM Index, and that has got everything you need to know in emergency medicine with just like a scaffolding type approach of information that then you can just, you know, broaden yourself with. And then honestly, everything is on YouTube. Everything, like
literally
the first chest wall block I ever did, or learning anything ultrasound wise, 5 minute sono on YouTube. Fantastic. So just, you know, you just need to get out there and just like look for things and then try and sort of uncover like you know, what your gaps are, and then be, you know, brave enough to sort of just admit what your weaknesses are and try and build them up.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.